Hi, and welcome to the Animal Training Academy podcast show, the show for animal training and behavior nerds, where I, Ryan Cartledge, interview the world's most proficient animal training and behavior geeks. We're absolutely thrilled and grateful to have you here with us today. So make sure you hit that subscribe button on whatever you're listening to this on so that you don't miss a single episode. Each episode of this show is brought to you on behalf of the ATA membership. And if you like the conversations in this episode, then you're invited to continue them with like-minded behavior nerds within the membership area, which you can find out more about at www.animaltrainingacademy.com. Once part of the ATA tribe, you'll get access to twice monthly live web classes, the back catalogue of previous web class replays, plus a huge library of videos and projects to help problem solve your training challenges. Plus, we're a sociable bunch with an exclusive private Facebook group and forum areas. It's like a Netflix social media platform for animal behavior geeks. But we will get started on today's episode where we'll be talking to one Bex Tasker. Bex is a lifelong behavior and training nerd with a special interest in positive reinforcement training for horses and their humans. She is dedicated to promoting principles of compassion, clarity, and consent within horse-human partnerships. Almost 20 years of positive reinforcement training and the excitement of being able to talk to the animals has not dimmed. She is known for clicker training any animal that crosses her path, including pigs, rabbits, dogs, fish, cows, sheep, cats, and her own child. Her first animal job in her 20s was with guide dogs and custom detector dogs. But more recently, via her business, Positively Together, she's focused primarily on horses. Bex travels around New Zealand teaching clinics on positive reinforcement for horses, as well as delivering online courses to horse trainers from around the world. She has a new but thriving youth program for teenagers focused on personal development via ethical horsemanship, and has recently delivered a string of workshops for businesses on how to inspire behavior change in their staff and clients using positive reinforcement principles. So without further ado, it's my very great pleasure to welcome one Bex Tasker to the show today who is patiently waiting by. Bex, thank you for taking time to come and hang out with us here at Animal Training Academy.
Thanks, Ryan. I'm super excited.
Not that you don't hang out with us at Animal Training Academy on a regular basis, because you've been a member for quite a while now, and it's a rare pleasure for me to welcome someone to the show who is just down the road, is from New Zealand, so I'm excited about that.
We've got the double Kiwi accent going on today.
Yeah, everyone's hopefully going to be enjoying this, if not struggling to understand what we're saying. We'll try to articulate our words for you, everyone. Hey, let's dive straight into the first question today, Bex. Could you please take everyone listening back to the start of your journey, where you first learned about positive reinforcement animal training, and share with us some stories from that time?
Sure. So I have had horses and dogs all my life, but it wasn't until I got out of horses in my late teens, got a boyfriend like so many girls do, got out of horses, especially when I had to start paying for them myself, and got a dog. And the first dog that I got was an Alaskan Malamute, which was an incredible learning curve, shall we say. And I took him along to a domestic obedience class. It was sort of one of those, you know, suburban classes. There was an older English lady who would march us around in circles. We were all wore choke chains and, you know, teaching the dogs to heel and things like that. So this would have been about the year 2000. But at the end of that 6 week or whatever it was course, she handed out clickers, which in hindsight seems quite strange. I remember she had border collies and she did film work with her border collies, so probably that's where she got them from. I don't think from memory she knew much about what they were for or how they worked, but on the back of that clicker, and I still have it, I should really frame it, put it on the wall. On the back of that clicker was KarenPryorClickerTraining.com. And I went home and got on the website and researched and basically dived into years of just everything that I could possibly read. Started with the website Read Don't Shoot the Dog, just was completely obsessed for a very long time, and to be fair, still am, almost 20 years later, with learning everything that I could about behavioral science and learning theory and how animals learn. Because I think the thing was, I felt like this fog had been lifted. I felt like, you know, I'd had horses. I was show jumping and doing all this stuff with my horses and my dog at home, but never really understood how what I was doing was working and why it was working. And I felt like suddenly I just had this, the fog had lifted. It had all just been unlocked for me, and I could sort of read the code all of a sudden. And that was super exciting. So that's how I first discovered positive reinforcement, and continued on with the dogs. And then got into horses again about 5 years later, and started attempting to train them with positive reinforcement. I say attempting because it didn't go too well. I tried to train my horses like they were dogs. And yes, the principles of learning theory are the same no matter the species. However, horses really require quite different foundation behaviours, and they're quite different to train in my experience than dogs are. So it took me quite a while to figure out how to get through those early stages. I created a couple of horses that I had. I created a lot of anxiety and biting and mugging and foraging for food and those kind of behaviours. It wasn't much fun for the horse in the early days when I was still figuring it all out, but I've gotten a lot better at it since. Yeah.
Yeah, we often say we feel sorry for the animals that we trained in those times, but grateful for the lessons that they helped us learn.
Yeah, yes, exactly. I used to do a lot of sled dog racing with my Malamute, and I remember sitting in the in the middle of the forest at, on these overnight sled dog racing camps, and I'd have all my friends' Malamutes and Huskies, and I'd be target training them and stuff around the fire in the hall, because certainly with those kind of dogs there was a lot of alpha rolling, a lot of talk about dominance based theories in terms of how people manage their dogs. So I really enjoyed introducing that population of dog owners to positive reinforcement. Yeah, I got really into it. I went along to big pet expos and took my Malamute and had him do all his tricks, and imported clickers from the US and wrote little booklets and gave them away to people, and was basically just trying to convert as many people as I could. So that was kind of my early days of positive reinforcement training. I was, pretty obsessive. Went on to train customs drug detector dogs, which was an amazing experience. I probably burned out a little bit after a couple of years. They trained with positive reinforcement. At that point, they were training with positive reinforcement for the actual searching for the drugs. So I was working particularly at Auckland Airport and in the mail centre and on some container ships and things like that. But the obedience stuff, which happened before you graduate, was all choke chains. So this really big black Labrador that was my dog, his name was Oscar. He was one of New Zealand's first white powder only detector dogs. So he was looking for heroin and cocaine and such things. And he was large. And basically the advice that I got from the trainers at that time was just to put more muscle into it, jerk harder on the choke chain, basically. And I vividly remember taking him, putting him in the van, feeling frustrated, putting him in the van and driving and hiding behind a warehouse at Auckland Airport, and clicker training him to walk on a loose lead and to sit when he needed to sit and do all those things, because I had such strong ideas about how I felt animals should be trained, and I didn't cope well with being told how to train my animals. I do much better working for myself, like I do now. I lasted a couple of years in detector dogs, and it was an amazing experience, and I learned a lot. And in hindsight, there was a lot that I would do better now, running an operational dog. But it's all part of the journey. Yeah.
I feel like there's people in this audience that might be in the position that you were in when you were working with the detector dogs, but now in 2019. So you shared with us that you'd go and hide behind shit and train the dog using positive reinforcement, thinking about all you've learned with regards to positive reinforcement and training humans and everything else that comes with that over the intervening time between then and now, what advice or what offerings might you have to share with those people who might be in similar positions that share similarities with the ones you just described?
It's tricky. I was, I think these days it's, well, I know in certainly, you know, the organisations that I'm aware of, they are beginning to use a lot more like marker training and positive reinforcement generally. So it's hopefully less of an issue these days. It was challenging in that I was in my early 20s and I'm dealing with a very male-dominated culture and, you know, the police dog instructors were using a lot of aversives, very strong aversives. I'm not sure that in putting myself back there, I'm not sure I could have challenged them because of the, you know, the hierarchy that I was in, the situation that I was in. But certainly if I had had more maturity and experience, I would have been able to at least question what they were doing. And, you know, they may well have been okay with me doing what I did. I don't know. But at that time, I certainly felt like I needed to, because I was going directly against their advice in terms of how to resolve these problems, particularly around the obedience side. Like I say, the actual searching operational work was all positive reinforcement. And you are really having to balance. I mean, I remember the struggle of balancing operational requirements in terms of what the dog needed to do versus the dog's training requirements. And, you know, I remember one team leader at Auckland Airport complaining about me because I was insisting that my dog did another training search and had a rest before we continued with operational work. And I didn't at that time have the mentors and the people sort of backing me up that had my back to support me in my decisions around managing my dog's needs. So probably I could have potentially done more to try to find, you know, talking to my seniors, talking to senior handlers and trainers about my dog's needs rather than just kind of charging on by myself and trying to manage it on my own. Yeah, it's a tricky one though. It is a tricky one.
I myself have been in my 20s in similar situations, now I'm grateful for the lessons I learned, but not so proud, shall we say, of how I potentially managed the situations at the time. But it's a pretty challenging situation to be in. I'm interested about what New Zealand was like at this time you first got handed that clicker. I feel in 2019, we're very connected now with the internet and all of these learning opportunities we have, but we still don't have Clicker Expo in New Zealand, all of these great mentors we have. You know, we're not meeting them in person. They are expensive plane rides away. What was it like back then with, like, even less available? How did you find a community, or were you just kind of feeling by yourself the whole time? Or?
Yeah, it was definitely lonely. And I mean, you know, from today's standards, it was very lonely. Obviously, this was all very much pre-social media and all that kind of stuff. It's certainly a lot easier now to find your tribe, to find your community these days. I was working off of, I mean, I was involved in all of those Yahoo groups and the email groups, the Clicker Solutions, and all those amazing groups of people with some of the trainers who are now absolutely at the top of their game, and back then we're still in that kind of exploratory phase. Not that we're not always in an exploratory phase, but you know, there was some exciting stuff happening then, and it was cool to kind of be a bit of a voyeur. I mean, I wasn't exactly part of that, but I was certainly watching with interest some of these names that I now know as Clicker Expo faculty and things like that. And I went to as many seminars and conferences and things as I could, and there was a few coming through in the dog world. So, you know, and I've maintained a bit of a tribe through getting to know people like that in the dog world. Whereas when I started to shift, so after I left customs and I felt a little bit burned out, I realised that I wasn't even enjoying my dog training anymore, which had been my overriding life passion. And I just had a bit of a break from that. And that's when I started doing it with the horses. I was very alone at that point because, you know, in the dog world, I mean, I took my dogs to agility training and I managed to find a club who was training with the clicker. So, you know, so I was around people. I intentionally sought out people who, you know, who I could consider to be a bit of a like-minded community. But when I moved away from dogs and into horses, I was absolutely alone. There was nothing. I was importing VHS videos from the States I was just battling through completely by myself and making all the mistakes and tearing my hair out and crying and saying it doesn't work on horses, it's not going to work, and then trying again because I just felt so strongly at a gut level that this is what I wanted to be doing and that it did make sense and obviously there's something wrong here. And you know, I had Alexandra Kurland's book, but that you just can't, for me it wasn't enough. I would have liked to have someone teaching the kind of clinics that I'm teaching now. And there just wasn't that back then, yeah.
We have talked about these things called VHS videos and Yahoo groups before in this podcast.
But,
it's really neat that these are recurring resources that podcast guests talk about when they talk about the Stone Age. No, I'm just joking. So something that sticks out to me is, you know, you and I together this year have been to Susan Freeman's and Peter Clark's learning event in Australia together. We've been to Ken Ramirez's APDT 5-day, was it 5 days, 3-day workshop here in New Zealand. Yeah, and, you know, we're not complaining at all about living so far away because we do have these amazing opportunities. And you and I have had some fun. You invited me to come and hang out at one of your clinics and get to geek out about animal training and behaviour. And you've just shared you're going to Clicker Expo in America next year. So something that sticks out to me is your desire to never stop learning, and paired that with what you're telling us now about you kind of going behind the shed with your dog, you jumping into the horse world and kind of being quite lonely. Like, I'm interested to learn more about your mindset. Like, where does your drive and motivation come from to keep learning and to keep kind of questioning the norm and following your gut, which I'm interpreting as you telling us is saying to you, hey, there's a better way to do this. How does your mind
work? And I had some, you know, in terms of following my gut, I mean, I had some experiences early on that I think helped to shape that, as I'm sure does everyone. You know, I've got a vivid memory of being about 15 and I was, so this was before I knew anything about anything, but I was show jumping at a relatively high level and my horse continued to badly stop at jumps and try to basically nap, which means try to move sideways out of the arena. He didn't want to be there. And I couldn't do anything about it. He was a big animal and I was a skinny little 15-year-old. And my trainer got on him and rode him away. And when he came back, he had welts all over his rump, big ones. And you know, things like that, things like the police dog instructor who took my dog Oscar off me when I was down there for my graduating course and jerked the choke chain so hard that Oscar screamed and flew through the air. And I had to not show that I had tears in my eyes because I was this silly little girl and they were these older men in the police force. And yeah. So those kind of experiences are what probably formed such a strong gut feeling that I know what is ethically right and the way that I want to be treating my animals and interacting with my animals. And so that those experiences obviously form a large part of sort of that side of things. In terms of the desire to learn, I just find it all so exciting. Like, how could you not want to be the best at this you could ever be? Because it's just so much fun. And like, once you get really good at training a dog, then you've got all these other animals that are just actually completely different. And whether it's just silly fun stuff, it's the conversation, it's the dialogue that I'm having with the animal as I'm training them that I just find so incredibly exciting. And to get better at that and to be, you know, yeah, I just I just never get sick of learning about this stuff. So I am an analyst by nature. When I burned out from customs, I went into intelligence within law enforcement. I was in law enforcement intelligence for about 10 years. That's what my master's is in, criminal intelligence. So I am a bit of an analyst, a bit of a researcher, naturally. I've got, you know, that's sort of how I'm built. But yeah, it's just, it's the fun of just how much fun is this? Like, I want to get really, really good at this. I want to be better at this. I want to train new things. I want to train new kinds of animals. It just never gets boring. So, yeah.
And I've been to your clinics, and you've had the ones I've been to and the learning opportunities that you offer that I've been to. There's been a pretty broad range of people there, some who have been clicker training for a number of years, some who this is their first kind of introduction to positive reinforcement, and holding a clicker in their hand with their horse on the other side of them. How has your experience in the challenges that you've faced in your career, how has that helped you become a better teacher now? Are you kind of in front of those people when you see Bex Tasker in them?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think it helps to have compassion, doesn't it? To be able to understand. And arguably, I've got less of that than some. You know, I've got some colleagues who have come through quite a traditional horsemanship background as an adult and done a lot of learning in what we call natural horsemanship and then have changed to positive reinforcement, whereas I've been training with positive reinforcement all of my adult life. So I may not have... I can't exactly look back and think of things that I've done with my horses that I deeply regret, and that I never trained with really aversive methods with my horses. I was lucky enough to discover it quite early. But at the same time, there's always things that we wish we'd done better. And I think just having compassion for people at whatever stage they're at in the journey is really key as a teacher. And I feel really strongly that we, as positive reinforcement trainers, you know, our goal is to spread the word as widely as possible, right? Is to get as much positive and non-aversive and humane and ethical training to as many animals and as many people as possible. And to do that, we need to shape humans' behaviour. We need to welcome them with open arms, even if they're only ready to dabble in it a little bit, or they're only beginning to discover it a little bit. I'll take it. If you want to train your horse with traditional horsemanship methods, but you're going to try using the clicker for one issue, like taking a worming tube, I'll take it. Come to my clinic and we'll teach you how to do that. And my experience overwhelmingly is that once they have a play with it and they see it at the clinic and they really understand how it works and they play with it in the one issue that they might have that requires work, then I'll talk to them 6 months later and they're absolutely clicker training for everything. You know, they're because they've realised how much fun it is and what a difference it makes to the horse. So I just think, yeah, super important to me that everyone is made to feel welcome no matter what stage they're at. Yeah.
So could you say you celebrate approximations?
Absolutely. That's exactly what I aim to do all the time.
Yeah. You like to spread ripples?
Yeah, ripples, definitely. As many as possible. That's right. And, you know, like, I think it's easy. And I see it a lot, particularly with I was going to say younger, but, you know, newer trainers to the positive reinforcement paradigm, get very... I sometimes see them get quite kind of extreme and because they feel so strongly and so passionately about what they're doing. And the risk, of course, is that we can shut people out. And I've got one colleague here who I respect very highly, who's relatively new to positive reinforcement. And it took her many years to even learn about clicker training for horses because of the fact that she had run into quite close-minded people, particularly in social media. So positive reinforcement trainers who were not welcoming, who were judgmental. She's now spreading positive reinforcement ripples with her clients, but it took her more years than it should have because she didn't discover it as early as she could have, I guess, or embrace it as early as she could have because of the fact that she unfortunately ran into groups of people or individuals who weren't completely welcoming and who weren't necessarily celebrating approximations in terms of people who are new to positive reinforcement but have decades of experience in other types of animal training, other types of horsemanship. So, yeah.
I'm very tempted to go into the metaphor of ripples now and how that applies to that situation, but I'm going to contain myself. You have to share a photo of that original clicker with us so we can include it in the write-up for this podcast. That'd be kind of neat.
Sure.
Before we move on to talk about the middle part of the sandwich of this podcast, bringing everyone listening up to speed now, what are you doing in 2019? You've kind of shared little snippets of that, but unpack that a little bit more and where they can go to find out more, get in touch with you.
Cool. So my business is Positively Together. So I started that up sort of officially 4 years ago. I've been training people in the odd clinic and stuff for a long time, but this is when I quit what I used to call my real job and started doing this full-time. I'm traveling around New Zealand and I'm teaching, so once or twice a month I'm around New Zealand teaching clinics. In other words, 2 days, so over a weekend with 8 to 10 horses at each. Clinic people coming to learn how to use positive reinforcement training with their horses. I'm teaching like theory workshops, PowerPoint evenings, that kind of thing, about how animals learn generally. And I'm also doing what I'm calling the youth program. So I'm doing increasingly more lessons and group sessions with young people at my property with my own horses. And those are around it's personal development, it's life skills, it's teaching the principles of consent and compassion and how to be a good friend and all that kind of stuff with positive reinforcement horse training as the medium for that. So, you know, you can't get kids to buy into coming along to learn to be a better friend, but you teach them about horse training and they're all about it, right? And there are so many parallels between the way that we train ethically, positive reinforcement training with animals and the way that we can become a better human. So that's I'm really excited. I'm really enjoying that work with youth as well. So that's what I'm doing amongst a variety of other things. I've actually just been invited to the US to teach a clinic next year, which will coincide with my trip to Kentucky to go to Clicker Expo. So that's very exciting. I'm in terms of finding me, Facebook is probably my major platform. So that's Positively Together on Facebook and on Instagram as well. And my website is clickertraining.co.nz. So that's where to find out more. And I have a Facebook group, which is free for anyone to join. And there I post like weekly short snack size kind of videos about different topics and that kind of thing. Oh, and I'm also running online courses as well. So, yeah, lots of balls in the air.
Awesome. And we'll link to all of this in the write-up for this podcast. So if you needed to go back and find this after you finish listening, then you can find it on the ATA website. Hey, thanks so much for sharing all of that so far, Bex. I love hearing about people's behavioral odysseys, as we like to call them here, and your odyssey still has a long way to go. I'm excited to see what you get up to over the next 4 years. Moving forward, though, I'd like to unpack even more some of the things that you've already talked about today and some of the things you just started to talk about just then as you're describing what you do in 2019. But this is more a bigger umbrella about how positive reinforcement has helped change your life. And when we caught up to discuss topics for this episode, this is what you told me that you really wanted to talk about. And so you've prepared 5 things to share with us about how positive reinforcement with horses has taught you about leading a better life and also about training other species, including humans. Can you share this list of amazingness with us, please, Bex?
Sure. So as a bit of context, I think the big kind of epiphany for me over the last 4 years, you know, when I started this business, I was about helping horses. I was about trying to help the horse world catch up with the dog world in terms of where the general understanding and use of positive reinforcement is concerned. And what I'm increasingly realizing is that I'm less about training horses and I'm actually more about training people. We train an animal and we help that animal. We inspire and educate a person and we're helping every animal that person will ever come into contact with for the rest of their lives. So I'm becoming increasingly aware that that's probably where my deepest passion actually lies, is in inspiring behavior change and understanding and, you know, influencing humans for the greater good, so to speak. And the way that and becoming increasingly aware too of how positive reinforcement principles and the life the way that they have impacted my life over the last almost 20 years. So I've got a 5-year-old son. So just becoming a parent, I guess I'm realizing I've got more of an appreciation for the wider life impact of positive reinforcement and who I am as a result of the last few decades of animal training and of focus on positive reinforcement. So it's not just a hobby which results in well-trained pets, right? It's life-changing impacts. I'm a better mother because I'm a positive reinforcement animal trainer. I'm a better friend. I'd like to think I'm a better wife. I don't know what my husband would say about that. I find myself using positive reinforcement principles, using tag teach principles in my everyday life. So teaching groups of people in clinics, which is probably the thing that I most enjoy doing, is group, you know, teaching groups of people. And in order to learn effectively, a human's got to feel safe. And creating that safe, supportive environment in a group learning situation is the responsibility of the coach. So helping them to feel confident to ask questions. You know, and these are all the things we're doing with our animals when we're training our animals too. So that's kind of the context for where this has all gone, where it's come from. When I became a parent, if I was going to say that I follow a parenting approach of any kind, I would name Rye, which is R-I-E. That's a parenting approach from Magda Gerber. If anyone's interested in that, Janet Lansbury does an amazing job of writing blogs and incredible amounts of resources for parents. And really, that's all about viewing babies and children as unique humans worthy of our respect and trust, which is such a centre. Such a core part of how I like to train my horses too. Having respect for them as individuals and the fact that they've got their own motivations and their own lives that are outside of me, rather than seeing our horses and our other animals as something that we use or, especially in the horse world, you know, often the horse is less a friend and more of a tool, more of a piece of sports equipment for some people. That's, you know, they would never say that. They love their horses, but it is still ultimately very kind of a human-centric thing. It's what can the horse do for me? So that's kind of the background behind what led me to suggest that topic. So if I was going to say five things, I'm going to start with gratitude. So five things that positive reinforcement animal training, horse training has taught me about leading a better life. Gratitude, you know, positive reinforcement training by definition means that we need to notice the good things, right? If we're going to reinforce behaviour and get more of the behaviour that we want, then we need to first notice the behaviour. And so in itself, training with positive reinforcement clicker training teaches, you know, that's my daily practice of gratitude. It teaches me, it trains me to notice, to overcome the normal human negativity bias where we focus in on the things we don't like more than we do on the desirable things. And, you know, every time I'm out there training, I'm practicing gratitude, seeing the good things. And my experience is that seeps out into your wider life and, you know, it becomes a cornerstone habit. So Oliver is 5.5 and I believe that I'm better at noticing and acknowledging those little day-to-day moments, the things that he's doing right. You know, if he's patiently waiting while I have a phone call with someone or a conversation with someone, I find it easier to actually notice and acknowledge him for doing that. Because of the fact that this is every day, right? When we're training, we're doing that. We're acknowledging and noticing the good things rather than just waiting for the behaviour we don't like and correcting it, which would obviously be the more traditional animal training model. And actually, when you look around, you realise that there is a lot of people who are parenting that way as well. So gratitude would be the first thing on my list. Compassion would be another. So this is huge. And, you know, like you mentioned, we went to Susan Friedman's and Peter Clark's, what do you call that? It wasn't a seminar. It was 4 days of amazingness anyway. You know, and they, you know, obviously Susan Friedman talks a lot about what's the function, what's the function of the behavior, understanding why the animal's doing what it's doing. And to me, that's one of the core things that, you know, of compassion. If we can understand what's the function of the behavior that we don't like. So I'm talking about particularly in a human. And you know, another Susan Friedmanism is the unlabel me movement, right? And if you think about it, unlabel me is really about, everyone's trying their best. It's about looking, giving people the benefit of the doubt. This is the way that I unpack it anyway, that I frame it in terms of my interactions with other humans. You know, he's not being lazy or rude or selfish. It's, you know, what's the function of that behavior? What's really behind that? What am I seeing? And what might be the drivers for that? So that I've got a 15-year-old student. She's 16 now. She was having some trouble with some girls at school who were, I wouldn't call it bullying, but it was pretty, you know, difficult sort of behaviour for her to deal with in the hallways. And, you know, she used to get angry or upset about this, as you can imagine, that sort of, you know, being shoved or pushed or blocked through doorways and that kind of stuff that teenagers sometimes do to each other. But I'll never forget, about a year ago, she came to me and said that this had happened, that these girls had been quite rough and quite unpleasant to her in school. And what she did is she sat down with her notebook and she wrote a functional assessment for, you know, for those other students. You know, she was talking about distant antecedents and you know, what might be driving that behavior and, you know, what might be happening at home that might be causing them to behave that way. And, you know, ultimately what that did was helped her to empathize with the people who were doing that bullying behavior, right? So I think that was a bit of, all of this has been some light bulbs for me in the terms of how we're taking things like, you know, functional assessments, you know, ABCs and labels and the functions of behaviour and all that stuff, which can seem quite dry and sciencey to some people, but actually this is at the core of humanity. You know, for her to be able to, for a teenager to be able to sit down and be compassionate towards someone who's bullied her, and to think logically about how she can arrange antecedents or consequences to influence the behaviour of those other teenagers who are acting in a way that she doesn't appreciate, that was just really exciting for me. Kathy Sadeo gave an amazing quote. Wasn't that on your podcast? Was it on ATA one? She said, "You can't seek to influence someone's behaviour from a position of contempt." Anyway, I wrote it down because I loved it. I love Kathy Sadeo, she's amazing. But that particular quote jumped out at me because, again, this is the way that she was referencing how we treat other people who train in different ways to us. But it's just so applicable. These kind of principles are so applicable just across life, really. You asked for five. I'm on number three. Holding space for another person, I don't know how else to phrase that. You could call it respect. This is about acceptance. It's about, you know, acknowledging it's just behaviour. We don't need to take it really personally, which is such a relevant thing in the horse world. I find myself talking about this a lot with horse trainers, about just accepting their behaviour, not taking it personally, not labelling it again. It's not dominance. It's not rudeness. It's not being naughty. It just is. Let's describe what we're seeing and talk about how we can resolve it. Again, particularly with horses, I find myself helping people a lot how to sort of remove the emotion from a situation. So not pandering or conceding, which I find that often people will fall on one side. Either they'll be very hard or they'll be overly pandering and conceding, and there's that nice middle ground of just acknowledging behaviour for what it is, being compassionate towards the animal or the person as to the reasons why they're behaving the way they are, and just going about changing it if that's something that needs to be changed, rather than pouring our own selves into that. I read something recently about the difference between empathy and compassion, and that was kind of what they were getting at, that compassion creates emotional distance, whereas empathy, you're feeling their emotions as your own, and therefore you can be clouded by your own biases rather than, just seeing it objectively. So I had a young horse years ago who was super reactive, super nervous about all sorts of stuff. Life was anxiety for him. And I spent a lot of years trying to avoid upsetting him, sort of tiptoeing around his reactivity, tiptoeing around the things that I knew would make him nervous or make him react. I was uncomfortable with his discomfort. And what I've realized now with a bit more experience is that actually what I needed to do is just hold space for him, just acknowledge that he's feeling that way and not avoid that, but help him work through it. So we're talking about counterconditioning and systematic desensitization, right? Like, you know, these are the practical frameworks for how to acknowledge an uncomfortable feeling, breaking it down, not taking it personally, but thin slicing it and working through it rather than just trying to avoid it. So I think I made that horse's, you know, what I'm going to call anxiety worse because I was personally uncomfortable with his discomfort. And I'm like that with humans too. I'm uncomfortable with conflict. And I'm learning, you know, like the crucial conversations and the nonviolent communication and all that stuff is so important because it's helping me to, to be okay, to be accepting of other people's emotions and to not take it into myself and feel defensive or whatever. When my little boy is anxious about something, I don't avoid the issue. I don't distract him. We talk about it. We talk about it openly and I coach him through it and we resolve how he's feeling. Or if it can't be resolved, then I just acknowledge the way he's feeling and accept that that's the way it is. So strategies rather than avoidance and distraction. So it's all actually the same stuff. You can see how like the parenting thing and the horse training thing have just really kind of developed each other. Again, like I mentioned, the Rye sort of philosophy. An example of that strategy is like toddlers squabbling over toys. What someone with the Rye approach would do in that situation is to calmly narrate what's actually happening, just describe what's happening to the children rather than swooping in and helping them to avoid conflict, actually just acknowledging and trusting them that that's their journey and that they can manage that situation themselves. So I see this with horses where we micromanage our horses. We're constantly over cueing. We're telling them exactly what to do at every single moment instead of just respecting their own choices and their own the way that they manage their world and their body and things like that. So I often see people, for example, asking their horse to line up to a mountain block so that they can get on. And it will be, you know, can you take two steps forward and one step back? And then I'm going to move your hip over and then I'm going to, you know, use the reins to move you this way. And what I coach about in my clinics is actually just let's explain to the horse what we want them to do and just allow them to do it rather than constantly, micromanaging their behavior. And the horses really appreciate that, as you can imagine, because it allows them to think for themselves. It gives them autonomy over their own bodies and, you know, and some choice about how they do it. If I stand on the mounting block and hold my hands out in front of me, my horse will put his saddle underneath my hands. I don't care how he does it. I don't care whether he takes two steps to the left or to the right or, you know, comes in laterally or what. And because they understand what the behaviour is they actually want rather than just mindlessly responding to cues, then, you know, I get a lot more enthusiasm and cooperation from the horse in terms of that kind of thing. It also means with mounting blocks that I can use it as a question. So if my horse doesn't respond to my cue to line up to the mounting block, then I know that he's not happy for me to get on. And I sure as heck am not going to get on a 600 kg animal, flight animal, if he isn't ready for me to do so. So it's good information for me as well. So this is where the control and the choice things come in, I guess, in everyday life. Another one that's super important to me, and I touched on it just then with talking about bodily autonomy, is consent. So this is something that I talk about a lot with the youth that I work with. And I may not talk about it explicitly, but you know, I'm teaching primarily young girls, And issues of bodily autonomy and consent, this is life skills. This is crucial, obviously crucial for young men as well. But you know, I'm particularly passionate about teaching these principles to young women, that if we can have compassion for our horse, if we can read the body language of an animal and respect them when they say no to us, then I feel that those young women are going to be more likely to internalize those messages and understand the importance and the fact that those principles apply to themselves as well in future years. So things like teaching kids to and adults to understand calming signals, body language from horses. My cat is a great help, and my chickens also, in teaching these concepts when I do workshops at my place, because you know, if you don't approach her in the right way, then she just will walk away. You don't get a cuddle if you don't ask properly. I've got a couple of younger kids who are on the autism spectrum, and their parents bring them to me for lessons for these reasons, because they want the kids to learn about concepts like compassion and consent. It's not just about getting on the horse and going for a ride. It's so much deeper than that. It's the underlying principles. So I've got a pony called Blue. He's a little guy. He's for the smaller kids. He's just perfection. But he's learned in his previous life that if he just plants his feet, doesn't matter that he's small, you can't move him. He gives great learning opportunities to the kids in terms of getting the consent of the other of the animal they're working with. So I'll tell them to walk up there and put his halter on, or to take him for a walk, and he plants his feet and says, "I'm not going to move." Then they have to figure out, well, let's problem solve that. What are we going to do about that? Because we don't hit ponies at my place. That's not what we do. So what are we going to do? We're not going to haul on his face. That's not an option. So, you know, because it doesn't feel good for him. So what could we do? And so you see them thinking about it, and then they'll run and they'll find a target stick, or they'll get some treats. So thinking about, you know, why is he doing that? How could we? So this is me coaching the kids through, younger kids and teenagers, how can we provide reinforcement that will change his behaviour? So, you know, if he wants to eat the grass, what would he like more than grass? How could we help to get him on board so that we're doing this together rather than just you telling him what to do? If he's not on board with it, then you don't get to have fun. So you better have a think about how you can get him on board. And aren't these the same skills that these kids need to learn when they're interacting with their peers? You know, like it's all, you know, it's not just about how do we get the pony to cooperate. It's about helping them to draw the parallels between what's happening in a lesson with an animal and what happens in their day-to-day life. I'll say to them, how can we set up, I won't use these words, but how can we set up the antecedents so that he's going to be more successful next time? You know, maybe we could let him to graze on the grass for an hour before the kids arrive, or all that kind of stuff. It's the work that Peggy and Eva and Emily are doing around start buttons. You know, all that kind of stuff adds so many more valuable layers and like structure and a framework to these concepts. So that's that my teenagers in particular really enjoy talking about and learning about start buttons and dialogue within training sessions and how they can get that communication going. And man, there's nothing more exciting for me than to see a young person having their first real conversation with an animal, you know, having actual dialogue with an animal and responding to them in as much as the animal's responding to the human, and seeing that and they feel it and they get so excited about it. And once you've lit that spark, you know that they're set for life, because they'll never accept anything else. My dream is to set up some kind of long-term community pony club alternative, I suppose I'd like to say, to support these kids, because my concern is that I open up Pandora's box and then where are they going to go from there? Certainly with the youth, my goal is to just insulate them against the kind of views that they will get presented with when they go out to mainstream horsemanship. So they, you know, I mean, the number of stories I've heard of just the other weekend, I was talking to a friend who's in her 30s, but she was recalling a story from when she was 10, and she used to cry because she didn't want to go to pony club because they would make her hit her pony. I've got teenagers currently who have withdrawn themselves from pony club because they don't want to put a metal bit in their horse's mouth, and that's a requirement for doing the sport that they want to do, and so therefore they're not able to compete in the sports that they want, that their peers are competing in and that they have fun doing, because they are standing by the ethics, and that makes me super proud. The last one is self-awareness. So there's a great quote from Viktor Frankl that says, between stimulus and response, there is a space. In that space is our power to choose our response, and in our response lies our growth and our freedom. This is something probably that's quite close to my heart, in that I remember being a kid and running around after my pony who refused to be caught, and how angry I felt. And knowing that when she eventually came to me and I eventually caught my pony, that I wasn't able to take out that incredible anger on her, because it wouldn't help anyone. But, you know, these feelings of fear or frustration or the knee-jerk reactions, you know, when we become animal trainers, we get better, I think, at identifying that, at sitting in that space between stimulus and response, and being present and teaching ourselves to take a breath and think before reacting. I think especially with horses, because they're a 1,000-pound flight animal, they're dangerous. And a lot of the time people's anger or aggression or things like that with horses comes from a deep-seated fear of the potential injuries, and very real injuries. And all horse people have got broken bones and stories about the injuries they've had. And so it's not a thing to be dismissive of, but teaching ourselves how to take a breath and just to think before we react, and how to manage our emotions, control our mind chatter and our breathing and our energy levels, so that we can be the person that our horse needs us to be. Yeah. So that's five things for you, Ryan.
Can you repeat that Viktor Frankl quote for us?
So between stimulus and response, there is a space. In that space is our power to choose our response. In our response lies our growth and our freedom.
It's amazing. And that's kind of what we're teaching animals a lot of the time as well.
Yes, exactly. Like, you know, again, with horses who have such an incredibly fast reaction time, and for whom safety is absolutely the most important priority, physical safety, you know, they're constantly at fear of the mountain lion that's about to jump out from behind the tree. Teaching them to be able to think rather than just react is crucial for our safety when we work with them, and for their own well-being, really. So absolutely, we're doing it with our animals all the time. But, you know, we could always, all of us humans could do with a little bit more of that as well, I think.
So many ripples being spread, and you even used the word spark in there, and we did a podcast with Linda Ryan last year, I believe. She talked about spreading, I'm challenged to say this because of the articulation required, spreading sparks, and you were doing a lot of that. So let's go through that list. I really love that first one, gratitude. So we're learning to look more for the things we like, and as I reflect on my role as someone who moderates, for lack of a better word, I don't like that word, but we'll use it for now, moderates online communities. I feel sometimes, and I'm not even talking about Animal Training Academy community here, because they're awesome, but other ones that I see, we as positive reinforcement trainers sometimes forget to do that when we're giving feedback, when we're engaging with other people. We don't necessarily look for what the person we're communicating with is doing correctly. We somehow revert back to examining those things that we don't like, that they're not doing. For you, how did you kind of, is that something that you initially had to work through, or were you always kind of able to look at all situations and pick out the things you like? And what do you, can you just unpack this a little bit more? Because I think that we're in such a important phase of learning how to engage with each other online, that I think there's a little bit of value in just talking about that a little bit more.
Yeah, I don't know whether it's something that I've just always done, or whether it's come from, I guess, my learning as an animal trainer, as a positive reinforcement trainer. Because for me, I was a different person when I was 18 years old. And so this is, but in terms of noticing the good and acknowledging the good, I agree with you. I think it's quite common for people who can be quite skilled at doing this with our animals to not be so good at doing it with humans. Particularly when you've got a screen and a keyboard between you and the other human. So I think that the virtual nature of much of our communication these days can decrease compassion, which means that we are less likely to notice the good stuff, which is that gratitude piece that you're talking about. So I like to be conscious I like to be to take this to top of mind. So I mean, like you, I admin Facebook groups, for want of a better word, create communities, create tribes. This is one of my great passions. I think, again, because when I was younger, I didn't have that. When I was new, you know, as we've talked about, I didn't have that community around me and I wanted it. And so that's one thing that I consider to be a really important role is to create communities and get people together so they can support each other, irrespective of me and what I might be doing. And it's about calling it to the surface. And, you know, you do a beautiful job. Anyone who's been in the ATA communities has seen this in practice. I have taken learnings from the way that you manage the ATA community into my own Positively Together with Your Horse Facebook group, which is the free one that anyone can join. But it's the same sort of thing that when you're managing groups of people, group psychology fascinates me, the way that, you know, different personalities can influence the overall culture and feel of a group. So obviously having 10 to 20 people in front of me in a small group training session is a lot easier than when you've got 500 people on a Facebook group, most of whom you don't know. So you're bringing it to the surface, I think, and just calling it out all the time. So in my online courses, I use tag teach principles in terms of I actually give them tag points that they need to work towards for themselves and click points that their horse needs to work towards. And when they post video, they have to talk about what it is that they like about what they've done. And if they're going to comment on someone else's posts, then, you know, one of the rules is that you need to be constructive and you need to talk about what you think that the person did well. So all those kind of things, I think putting structure and framework to it can help people to actually translate the concepts from animal training into interactions with humans. Yeah.
Awesome. I love all of that. And what a huge ripple getting a teenager to do a functional assessment on some of her peers that she was having a challenging time with. That's amazing.
That was very cool. And it's not the only similar story, you know, from these kids that I'm working with, where they're actually going, well, actually, you know, this person's being really unpleasant, but maybe she's got something going on at home. You know, maybe her dad's just left, or maybe she's, you know, like, I mean, who knows, you know, like literally maybe grandma's just died, or maybe, you know, maybe she was actually really upset, because when I'm upset, this is how I behave and I get really cold and distant. And so maybe that's why she's doing that, rather than that she's being a bitch, or, you know, so actually just that, you know, that, I mean, to take it from what is essentially, you know, yeah, a functional assessment through to ultimately it's compassion. It's having compassion for another human and therefore helping yourself by not feeling so hurt. And yeah, it's very exciting. I love it. The crossovers excite me.
Maybe she's just having a bad day rather than being a bitch. I love it.
Exactly. Pretty much. And, you know, can't we all feel better if we have that attitude?
So looking at time, we should push on. But just to go through that list again, and I absolutely love this. I don't think we've kind of taken this angle on things before in such a intentional conversation. But the five things that I'm going back to my notes here to make sure that what I say now matches up with what I said at the start. Five things about how positive reinforcement of horses has helped teach you about leading a better life and training other species, including humans. Number one for you was gratitude, having an attitude of gratitude. Number two, developing compassion. You share that beautiful story about that teenager using a functional assessment in a challenging situation that they found themselves in at school. You pretty much said ABA is the core of humanity.
Yeah, I did, didn't I?
Number three, holding space for another person and all about developing respect, which led beautifully onto number four, which was consent. And you shared some great stories about helping the teenagers and the children, some of them with learning difficulties, connect the dots between working with animals and their daily life, which is awesome. I love that. And number five, you shared that beautiful quote from Viktor Frankl, and that was about developing self-awareness. So just before we do head to the final question for the show, is there any final words you want to say on that topic? And thank you so much for sharing all of that with us, Bex. That was amazing. Your list of amazingness lived up to its name.
Excellent. I'm glad. No pressure, right? No, I think that kind of sums up. I mean, I could have done a list of 10, but I felt like they chunked up quite nicely into those sections. And this is all stuff which is really only becoming clear to me in the last couple of years, particularly. And again, the influence of being a mum and having the little science experiment running around in my house, which is what being a parent is. You're gonna love it. That's where all that kind of came from, and it's that underlying thing that actually it's made me a better person, and it's made me a better teacher of people, which ultimately is my most important role in this world, I feel.
Amazing. I'm looking forward to having, like you alluded to there, a science experiment join our house around about the 13th of March 2020. Hey, sadly, we are now at the final question for this episode, Bex, but we started off with you taking us back to when you were a teenager. You shared with us what you're up to in 2019 and where your thoughts are with all of that great stuff you just talked about. For now, for this part of this episode, though, I'd like you please to take us on a journey into the future and share what Bex Tasker would like to see happen over the next 5 to 10 years in a horse, an animal and human and earthling training world.
I love that, earthling training. So in the horse world, I am seeing rapid change over the last 2-3 years towards positive reinforcement training becoming more acceptable. It's not mainstream. It's still very niche in the horse world, very niche, and there's still plenty of judgment and people thinking that you're a bit of a weirdo, but I'm okay with that. And it is becoming more accepted. In the next 5 to 10 years, I would like to see it becoming mainstream. I've always felt, and I don't know how correct this is, but I've always felt like the dog world's maybe 10 to 20 years ahead of the horse world, certainly 10 years ahead in terms of clicker training kind of being a household. You know, if I ask my dog clients, do they know what clicker training is? Most of the time they've got some idea. That's what I'd like to see in the horse world. I'd like to see curiosity rather than defensiveness. So dropping the ego a little bit in terms of, yes, you've got 20, 30 years of horsemanship behind you. I'm not saying you're wrong. You've still got good training is good training, and we can shape your behavior to use more positive reinforcement. And, you know, so more curious learners rather than defensiveness, which is pretty common. An interesting one, I really like to see more options for competition. See, I'm not a competitive rider anymore. I was in my teens, but I'm not. Most of my clients are not strongly, heavily competitive riders. But I'd like to see more positive reinforcement friendly options for competition, because for a lot of horse owners, competition's an important part of their life. And, I'd like to, so there's an International Horse Agility Club, which is a worldwide organisation where you can, it's obstacle courses basically, it's all about horse-centered ethical training. That's the one example that I've got of, I've competed in horse agility internationally from my own home. You do it online through video, and I can click and treat my horse during the competition course and I don't get marked down for that. So that's the one example I have of a competition option that is positive reinforcement friendly. So if there was more, you know, in dressage, the higher you go up the levels, the more aversive bits, and you have to wear spurs and you have to wear a double bridle. And so it's not, it doesn't quite fit with a positive reinforcement mindset for most people. Not that you cannot clicker train at higher levels of dressage, you can, and also use bits. But so that would be one thing I'd like to see, just to give people more options, basically. And like I sort of alluded to, having more options for youth as well. So Pony Club is still quite traditional, comes from the British Horse Society. There's a lot of, you know, I remember ticking off boxes on the certifications for kids at Pony Club, and, you know, it was how to use your whip correctly and all that kind of stuff. There was certainly no box to tick about how to use positive reinforcement correctly. And like you said before, Ryan, yourself, regulation, some kind of certification process, that kind of thing for the animal training industry generally can only be a good thing, right? So, you know, I know that you're doing the Karen Pryor professional course, and that's something which I am keen to do soon myself as well, for the same reasons, basically, that I think it's important. And, to have that kind of thing in place so that people know what they're getting when they get a trainer. Yeah.
Awesome. And I really like the contribution there about you'd like to see more curiosity. I would as well.
Brave learners.
Brave learners. I've heard that phrase before. Sarah Owings would say, and that curiosity is something we talked about with Steve White on this podcast show. Hey, Bix, that does sadly now bring us to the end of this episode. This has been a ton of fun from myself and on behalf of everyone listening. Thank you so much for coming on the show today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. It was an absolute honour to be on the podcast. So thanks, Ryan.
We do, of course, really appreciate all of you tuning in today as well. And if you have enjoyed this episode and you were interested in carrying on the conversation about working with our animals in the most positive, funnest, choice-rich ways, then as mentioned at the start of this episode, the Animal Training Academy community is waiting for you. Head on over to www.animaltrainingacademy.com and click on the membership button in the main menu to learn more about what members are describing as the Netflix social media platform for behavior geeks. There's something there for absolutely everyone, and we're looking forward to having you join the tribe. That's it for this episode, though. We're going to wrap it up there. Thanks again so much, everyone, for listening. You'll hear from us again soon.